I used to think the most dangerous people at work were the loud ones, the ones who slammed doors, called you names, made enemies on purpose. I didn't understand the quiet kind of danger yet, the kind that arrives with praise, the kind that finds your weak spots like it's studying for an exam, the kind that makes you feel chosen. When he took an interest in me, I felt my whole body relax for the first time in years. I thought, finally, someone sees what I can do. Finally, someone is going to pull me forward instead of making me claw for every inch. That's how it starts, not with a hand on your thigh, not with a locked office door. It starts with a tension that feels like oxygen. It starts with a man who knows exactly when to smile, exactly when to lean in, exactly when to make you feel safe enough to stop guarding your own boundaries. And then one day, you realize you've been walking toward a line you never agreed to cross. I met Ciaran in a glass-walled meeting room that was always too cold, no matter the season. The kind of cold that keeps you awake, keeps you sharp, keeps you polite. I'd been at Armitage and Doyle Advisory for 6 months, still learning which emails needed a reply within 5 minutes and which ones could sit until after lunch without someone deciding you were lazy. Consulting work looks clean from a distance. Up close, it's hunger dressed as professionalism. People smile while they measure you. They say your name like they're tasting it, deciding if it belongs on a future org chart. I was 31 then, Irish, Dublin-born, and tired of starting over. I'd done the usual circuit, small firms, mid-size firms, one big firm that burned through juniors like kindling. I was good, not brilliant in the way people romanticize, just consistently, reliably good. I could hold a room, make a messy problem readable, deliver a deck that didn't insult the client's intelligence. I could work late without complaining, and I could take feedback without crying in the bathroom afterward. Those things shouldn't be rare, but they were treated like gifts. Armitage and Doyle was the kind of place that called itself high performance and meant high tolerance for quiet misery. We had a shiny office on the fourth floor of a renovated building near the river, all polished concrete and glass partitions. The reception area smelled like espresso and expensive diffusers. The walls were lined with framed awards that didn't mean anything to the people doing the actual work. Ciaran ran one of the strategy teams. He wasn't the youngest partner, but he wasn't old either. Early 40s, crisp suits, a watch that looked understated until you noticed it on purpose. He had that easy Irish charm that people abroad mistake for warmth. In Dublin, you learn the difference early. Charm is often just a tool. It can be generous. It can also be sharp. He'd asked to meet me after a client presentation where I'd handled a brutal Q&A without flinching. The client's CFO had tried to pin me down, tried to make me admit uncertainty so he could feel clever. I didn't give him that. I answered cleanly. I anchored every claim. I didn't apologize for knowing what I knew. Afterward, in the hallway, a few colleagues gave me the quick nod that passes for praise in places like that. Then there was an email from CRN. He wrote that he'd noticed my composure and wanted to invest in my trajectory. Those were his exact words. Invest, trajectory, as if my career were a stock and he had insider access. I should have rolled my eyes. I should have been wary. But my body responded before my mind did. Relief, validation, a small shameful thrill that someone with power had noticed me. That first meeting was normal enough. He asked about my background, what I liked, where I wanted to go. He listened in a way most people in consulting don't. No glancing at his phone. No looking past me like he was scanning for someone more important. He leaned forward slightly, elbows on the table, as if every word mattered. He told me he'd started out rough too. That he'd had to fight for respect. That he knew what it felt like to be underestimated. It was all very human. It made him feel safe. Then he said, casually, like it was an afterthought, that he'd like to mentor me. Not officially through HR, just informally. Because official mentorship programs were performative and designed to tick boxes. I laughed because it was true. And in laughing, I joined him. I became someone he could speak to like an equal, even though we both knew we weren't. That was the first warning sign, not the offer itself, but the way it was framed. You can build intimacy with a shared enemy. In this case, the enemy was the system, the company, the bureaucratic nonsense. He positioned us on the same side. After that, he he started pulling me into higher level work. He'd forward emails with a line like, "I want your brain on this." He'd add me to meetings where I shouldn't have been, where I was the youngest person in the room and the only woman besides someone from the client's admin team. It was flattering. It was also strategic. He was giving me access. And access creates loyalty. He'd stop by my desk sometimes, never too long, always in a way that looked professional to anyone watching. A quick update, a question, a compliment delivered like it was nothing. "You're sharper than most of the seniors. I like how you think. You don't shrink when men try to bulldoze you." He said these things like they were observations, not gifts, like he was just reporting facts. But they landed in me like promises. I started staying later when I knew he was still there. Not because he asked, because I wanted to be available, because I wanted to be seen as someone who matched his pace. That was another warning sign, my behavior shifting around his attention. In the beginning, the boundaries felt clear. We met for coffee in the building cafe. We met in meeting rooms with the blinds open. We talked about work, about politics in the office, about how to handle certain partners. He taught me things I hadn't been told outright before. Which people to avoid, which clients were vultures, how to phrase a disagreement so it sounded like alignment. He also asked me personal questions, but lightly, like he was careful not to be inappropriate. "Are you seeing anyone? Do you ever get lonely in this kind of work? Who do you trust here?" I answered more than I should have. Not because he demanded it, but because he made it feel normal. Like mentorship included knowing the shape of the person you were advising. And I was lonely. Consulting is full of people who are never fully present anywhere. We travel, we work, we pretend our friends understand why we cancel plans at the last minute. We pretend we're not tired. I'd been single for a while, not because I couldn't meet someone, but because I didn't have the energy to keep starting conversations that went nowhere. So when a man with authority looked at me like I mattered, like I was worth time, something in me softened. Something I'd kept armored for years. The first time he touched me, it wasn't sexual. Not overtly. We were walking out of a client meeting, and he placed his hand on the small of my back to guide me through a doorway. It lasted half a second. It could have been nothing. But it didn't feel like nothing. My skin noticed it. My mind noticed my skin noticing it. And I hated myself a little for that. Because I was proud of being unflappable, proud of being the woman who didn't get rattled. And suddenly my body was reacting like I was 22 and desperate for approval. That's what power does. It bypasses your cleverness and goes straight for your wiring. After that, the touches became slightly more frequent. A hand on my shoulder when he leaned over my chair to look at my screen. Fingers brushing my arm when he passed me a document. Always plausible. Always deniable. He started messaging me outside work hours too. Not constantly. Not in a way that would have looked obsessive. Just enough to keep the thread alive. He'd send an article and say, "Thought of you." He'd ask, "Still in the office?" He'd write, "You did well today. Proud of you. Proud of you." It was a mentor phrase, a father phrase, a lover phrase. It sat in all those places at once. I told myself it was harmless. I told myself I was lucky. I told myself I was building a relationship with someone who could genuinely my career. And he did help. That's the complication people don't like to admit. Predatory behavior doesn't always arrive as pure harm. It often arrives braided with benefit. It can make you feel like you're choosing it, even as the choices narrow around you. There were days when I felt like I'd been pulled into a private lane of the company. Like there was the normal world of deadlines and politics, and then there was this quieter world where Ciaran was shaping me into something sharper, higher. He started inviting me to join him for drinks after work. Not one-on-one at first, a small group, a client, a few colleagues. The kind of thing that was technically networking, but also social. Then one night, after most people left, he stayed at the bar with me. The lighting was low. The music was just loud enough to make you lean in. I remember the smell of whiskey and citrus, the condensation on my glass, the way my cheeks warmed as the day finally drained out of me. He asked me if I ever felt like I had to be twice as controlled as everyone else. I laughed and said yes, obviously, because the moment a woman is emotional at work, she's branded. He looked at me for a long second and said, "You're allowed to be human with me." That's when I felt the line move, just slightly. Not crossed, just shifted. He began to talk about his own life more. Not the polished career narrative, the messier parts. A marriage that sounded more like a partnership on paper than anything warm. A home that felt quiet. The weight of being responsible for people, for outcomes, for profit. He didn't say he was unhappy. He didn't say he was trapped. He didn't have to. He let me imagine it. I knew he was married. Everyone did. He wore the ring. He mentioned his wife Fiona in passing, usually in a way that sounded respectful. She worked in law, he said. Very smart, very intense. Sometimes he'd mention her in a way that made her feel like an equal opponent rather than a beloved partner. Fiona's not sentimental, he'd say, like he was describing weather. Fiona doesn't do small talk. Fiona expects excellence. I noticed he never spoke about her with tenderness, only admiration and mild irritation. He didn't say he loved her. He didn't say he didn't. He left a gap, and my mind filled it. That's another warning sign. When someone gives you partial information that encourages you to complete the story in your favor. At the office, our dynamic started to become visible in small ways. Not scandalous, but noticeable. He'd call on me in meetings more than anyone else. He'd back me up when I challenged someone. He'd offer me opportunities that made seniors bristle. I could feel it. The subtle shift in how people looked at me. Not respect, not exactly. Something closer to suspicion. I told myself they were jealous. I told myself they didn't like seeing someone rise quickly. I told myself it was sexism, which was true, but not the whole truth. Because there was also this, they could sense I'd been chosen. And being chosen by power always comes with a price. The first time someone hinted at it, it was a woman on my team, Eisling, who'd been there longer than me and had the kind of quiet competence that never got rewarded properly. We were standing by the printer late one evening, the office almost empty, the machine making that irritating, whirring sound. She glanced at the document coming out and said, "Ciaran's taking you under his wing, yeah?" I smiled too quickly. I said, "He's been supportive." She didn't smile back. She just said, "Be careful with men who think they own the people they support." Then she walked away, leaving me with my papers and the faint hum of fluorescent lights. I remember feeling defensive, angry, like she'd insulted something sacred, mentorship, opportunity, my own competence. But her words lodged anyway. Be careful. I tried to be careful. In the ways you can be careful when you don't want to lose what you're gaining. I started replying to his late-night messages a little slower. I kept our meetings more formal. I avoided being alone with him after drinks. I told myself I was managing it. He noticed, of course. He always noticed. One afternoon, he called me into his office. His office had a door that closed, but the walls were still glass, like the company wanted privacy without the appearance of it. There were blinds, but most people kept them open. Closing them was a statement. When I walked in, the blinds were half drawn, not fully shut, just enough to soften the view from the outside. He gestured for me to sit. He didn't talk about work at first. He asked if I was all right. He said I seemed a bit distant. I felt my throat tighten. I smiled and said I'd been busy. He leaned back and said, "I don't like feeling shut out by you." The phrasing was subtle, but it carried weight, shut out. Like access to me was something he expected. I laughed again because laughing was my armor. I said, "You're not shut out." He looked at me, and his expression was gentle, almost wounded. Then he said, "You know I'm in your corner, right?" I nodded. He continued, "I've put my reputation behind you. I've positioned you. I've made space for you in rooms that don't easily make space." It sounded like a reminder, like a receipt. Then he softened again and said, "I'm not asking for anything. I want us to be honest with each other." Honest, that word can mean intimacy. It can also mean submission. I told him everything was fine. I thanked him. I said I appreciated his support. I left his office with my heart racing and my skin buzzing, like I'd been cornered without a single threatening word. That was the moment I should have stepped away completely. But stepping away from a powerful man who has made you feel special isn't just a personal decision. It's a career decision. It's a social decision. It's a risk. And risk is something companies love to preach about until a woman takes one. So I stayed. I kept working. I kept saying yes to the opportunities. I kept telling myself I could keep it professional, and Sharon kept tightening the circle, slowly, like a hand around a wrist that starts as gentle guidance and ends as restraint. It didn't escalate in a dramatic moment. There was no sudden confession, no impulsive kiss in a hallway, no outrageous proposition that made the line obvious. It was more like weather changing. One day you realize you're sweating and you can't remember when it got this hot. He started using language that sounded personal, but could still be defended as professional. I miss your energy. I like having you close. You make this place bearable. Bearable. As if I was his relief. He also began to test small limits in ways that seemed almost playful. A joke that lingered too long. A compliment that drifted from my work to my body. That dress suits you. You look incredible when you're annoyed. You're dangerous when you're confident. I would smile tightly. I would redirect. I would act like I hadn't heard the second meaning. That was my first form of complicity, pretending not to notice, because noticing would require action. One night, we were both still in the office around 9. It wasn't unusual. Deadlines didn't care about human needs. Most floors were dark, but our team's area was still lit, scattered with people who looked like ghosts, hunched over laptops. Ciaran messaged me to come to his office. He said he wanted to review something before morning. I hesitated. I looked around at the emptying desks. I told myself it was work. It was always work, until it wasn't. When I stepped into his office, the blinds were drawn more this time. Not fully, but enough that anyone walking by would only see shapes. He had a deck open on his screen. He gestured for me to stand beside him, not sit. We went through a few slides. He pointed things out. He praised my thinking. Then he said softly, "You know you don't need to prove yourself to me." I didn't know what to do with that. My stomach tightened. I said something bland like, "I just want it to be good." He turned slightly in his chair to face me. His knee brushed mine. It might have been an accident. It might have been the point. He looked up at me, and there was a different kind of attention in his eyes. Not the analytical attention of a mentor. Something slower. Possessive. He said, "Have you ever wondered what would happen if we stopped pretending?" The air in the room felt thick. My body reacted first, because bodies do that. Heat, awareness, a surge of adrenaline that felt like attraction and fear braided together. I stepped back a fraction, pretending to adjust my posture. I said, "I don't know what you mean." He smiled as if I'd said something charming. He stood up then. He was close, too close. He didn't touch me, but his proximity was its own touch. He said, "I mean, I can see the way you look at me sometimes." That made me angry, not because it was entirely false, but because he was claiming my gaze as consent. I said, "I look at you because you're my boss." He nodded as if that was a joke. Then he said, "I'm not your boss. Not really. You don't report to me officially." "Technically true, functionally bullshit." I said, "You're a partner. That's power." He tilted his head and said, "Only if you let it be." That line hit me like cold water. It was so neat, so seductive, so cruel in its simplicity. "Only if you let it be." As if power was something I could opt out of, like an office social committee. He moved closer. He lifted his hand and tucked a strand of hair behind my ear. It was intimate. It was slow. It was absolutely not professional. My whole body froze. Not because I wanted it. Not because I didn't. But because the moment demanded a decision, and I didn't feel like I had the right kind. I should have pulled away. I should have told him to stop. I should have left. Instead, I stayed still. I let his fingers graze my skin. I let the moment exist. That was the second form of complicity. Freezing and calling it caution. He lowered his hand and watched my face. He said, "You're allowed." Allowed. Again, that language. Permission. As if he was the gatekeeper of what I could feel. I swallowed. My voice came out thinner than I wanted. I said, "This is not a good idea." He smiled like I'd impressed him. He said, "I didn't say it was." Then he stepped back, as if to prove he could stop, as if the restraint itself made him noble. He turned to his desk, clicked something on the screen, and said, "We're done for tonight. Go home." Just like that. I walked out of his office with my legs trembling, furious at him and furious at myself. I went to the ladies' bathroom and locked myself in a stall and sat there like a teenager trying to get her breathing under control. I told myself I'd draw a hard line now. I told myself I'd shut it down. I told myself I'd never be alone with him again. And then the next morning, he greeted me like nothing had happened. bright smile, casual tone, a comment about a client email. No trace of the intimacy, no acknowledgement. That gaslit my body. It made me question my own memory of the moment. Had it been that serious? Had I misread it? Was I being dramatic? That's how he kept control. He didn't demand secrecy. He created ambiguity. Over the next few weeks, he did something more calculated. He started confiding in me about other people in the firm. This director is gunning for you. That partner doesn't want women in front of clients. They'll use you and drop you if you don't protect yourself. He framed it as protection. He made himself the only safe person. He also began to create small, private rituals. A coffee delivered to my desk with a note. A late-night message after a big day. You made me proud. A seat saved beside him at events. A hand lingering at my elbow, guiding me through a crowd. People noticed. They always notice. Not because they're obsessed with you, but because workplaces run on pattern recognition. People watch for proximity to power the way animals watch for shifts in dominance. I could feel the looks, the slight pauses when I walked into a room, the way Isling stopped sharing certain information with me, the way a senior consultant, Declan, started making jokes that were just sharp enough to cut. Look at you, he'd say, always with Siren, you're flying. Flying, as if I was being lifted. I started to feel isolated, not because I was actually alone, but because I wasn't sure who was safe anymore. If I complained about Ciaran, would anyone believe me? Or would they assume I'd encouraged it? That I'd been ambitious? That I'd been strategic? The truth was messy. I was ambitious. I did want the opportunities. And yes, there was part of me that liked his attention, even as it scared me. Being desired by power does something to your ego. It can make you feel invincible and trapped at the same time. One evening, there was a client dinner, a long table in a restaurant with low lighting and expensive wine. The client's team laughed too loud. Our partners performed competence like theater. Everyone drank more than they should. Sharon sat beside me. He kept his hand under the table sometimes, fingers brushing my knee lightly, just once, then again. Tiny touches that no one could see. I kept my face neutral. I kept smiling. I kept answering client questions like my body wasn't on fire. After dinner, a few people went to another bar. I said I was going home. I meant it. Ciaran walked me outside anyway. The air was cold. The street was wet, reflecting the city lights. He stood close and said, I want to talk. I said, not here. He said, where then? I didn't answer fast enough. He stepped in and kissed me. It wasn't a quick peck. It was deliberate, claiming. The kind of kiss that assumes you're already his. My first reaction was shock. Then I kissed him back for a second. A second, maybe two. Then I pushed him away. I remember the taste of wine and mint and something metallic, like adrenaline. I said, stop. This can't happen. He looked at me with that calm confidence that makes you feel like you're the one being unreasonable. He said, you don't get to pretend you don't feel something. I said, this isn't about feelings. This is about your position. He sighed like I was exhausting. He said, you're not a child. You're not being forced. That line made me cold. It was weaponized choice. You're not being forced. As if coercion only counts when there's physical force. As if the whole system around us wasn't made of pressure. I said, I need to go. He stepped back, raised his hand slightly like he was surrendering. He said, fine, go. But his eyes didn't look surrendered. They looked like he was letting me go the way you let a dog off a leash, confident it will come back. That night, I didn't sleep. I lay in bed staring at the ceiling, replaying the kiss, the moment I kissed back, the moment I pushed him away. My mind kept swinging between disgust and longing and panic. I hated that my body had responded. I hated that part of me wanted the fantasy, the powerful mentor who chooses you, who sees you, who lifts you above the others. I also knew the reality. Men like that don't choose you because you're special. They choose you because you're available, because you're talented enough to be worth the risk, and because your ambition makes you less likely to blow things up. I started avoiding him. I rearranged my day so I wasn't alone in the office with him. I stopped staying late. I kept my replies short. I made excuses. He didn't react with anger right away. He reacted with woundedness. He'd message, did I do something wrong? He'd email, can we clear the air? He'd say in passing, I miss our talks. It made me feel guilty, which was insane. He'd crossed the line and somehow I was the one feeling like I'd been cruel. Then the tone shifted. He stopped giving me the best work. He stopped inviting me into the higher level meetings. He started criticizing small things he'd praised before. "This deck feels rushed. Your analysis is thin. You're not as sharp lately." It was subtle enough that I could tell myself I was imagining it, but I wasn't. I knew the pattern. I'd seen it before in different forms. Reward, intimacy, withdrawal, punishment. One afternoon, he called me into his office again. The blinds were fully drawn this time. He said, "Sit down." His voice was calm, but there was hardness under it. He said, "I don't appreciate being treated like I'm some kind of predator." The word landed like a threat, predator. He brought it into the room so he could control it. I said, "I haven't said that." He leaned forward and said, "But you're acting like it." I felt my pulse in my throat. I said, "I want this to be professional." He laughed once without humor. He said, "Professional, right? After the way you looked at me, after the way you kissed me back." There it was, the receipt again. I said, "You kissed me first." He shrugged like that detail didn't matter. He said, "You could have stopped it immediately." I stared at him. My hands were cold. My mind was racing. He continued, softer now, like he was offering a deal. He said, "I care about you. I'm not your enemy. But you're making this awkward. And awkwardness has consequences." Consequences. Not a threat, technically. Just a truth spoken like a warning. I asked, "What consequences?" He smiled slow. He said, "Don't make me spell it out. You're smart." That was the moment the charm dropped, just for a second. And I saw the mechanism underneath. Control disguised as affection. I stood up. I said, "I'm leaving." He didn't stop me. He just watched me walk out. After that, the workplace became a maze designed to exhaust me. Meetings moved without me. Decisions were made in rooms I wasn't invited into. I'd be asked for work at the last minute, then criticized for rushing. I'd deliver something solid, and it would be ignored. I started to doubt myself. Not because I wasn't good, but because I was being destabilized. I considered going to HR. The thought made my stomach twist. HR in a firm like that exists to protect the firm, not you. I'd seen enough. Complaints became files. Files became leverage. Leverage became silence. And there was the other fear, the one no one says out loud. If I reported him, people would assume I'd slept with him to get ahead, that I'd been complicit in the worst way, that my competence was just decoration. Even if I told the truth was messy. There had been that second of kissing back. There had been the hours of accepting his praise and access. There had been my own ambition, my own need. Predators love messy truths. They thrive in the gray. So I did what a lot of women do. I tried to outwork it. I tried to be perfect enough that he couldn't touch me. I tried to prove I deserved what he'd given me, even as he took it away. It didn't work, because the problem was never my performance. The problem was that I'd stopped giving him what he wanted. The breaking point didn't come with a scream. It came with an email, a project I'd been leading quietly, one that could have been a real step up for me, was reassigned. No explanation, just a calendar update stripping my name from meetings, replacing it with Declan's. I stared at the screen for a long time, my hands hovering over the keyboard, like I might type my way out of it. I walked to Ciaran's office. The blinds were open now, bold, public, as if transparency could wash away anything that happened behind glass. He looked up when I entered, expression neutral. I said, "Why was the project reassigned?" He blinked slowly and said, "We needed someone with steadier client rapport." Steadier. I laughed, but there was no humor in it. My voice shook. I said, "I've been the one managing that client for months." He shrugged again, that same casual dismissal that made my stomach turn. He said, "Things change." I leaned forward, lowering my voice. I said, "Is this because I told you no?" His eyes flicked for the first time, just a flash of irritation, then calm again. He said, "Don't be dramatic." Dramatic, the word women hear when they name reality. He stood up and came around his desk. He didn't touch me. He didn't need to. He stood close enough that I could smell his cologne. He said, "I've given you a lot. You could have handled this differently." I stared at him. My chest felt tight. My mind felt oddly clear. I said, "Differently how?" He smiled like he was disappointed in me. He said, "With trust, with loyalty." Loyal, not to the firm, to him. That was the truth stripped bare. He saw mentorship as ownership. He saw his investment as a contract. And in his mind, I was in breach. I stepped back. I said, "You're punishing me." He raised his eyebrows as if I'd said something absurd. He said, "I'm managing resources." That was the moment I realized there would never be a clean confrontation. No admission, no apology, just corporate language designed to blur harm into process. I walked out of his office, and for the first time, I didn't feel confused. I felt furious, but fury at work is dangerous. It makes you reckless. It makes you say the truth too loudly. So I did something quieter. Something I'd learned over years in workplaces. I started documenting every reassignment, every critical note that contradicted earlier praise, every late-night message, every subtle shift in access. I didn't do it with the fantasy that HR would rescue me. I did it because I needed my own proof. I needed to stop doubting my memory. As I gathered it, I could see the pattern like a map, the attention that built me up, the intimacy that blurred lines, the punishment that came when I resisted, all of it threaded through one thing, his control. The next week, there was a leadership offsite, a hotel conference room outside the city, a day of strategy talk, then dinner, then drinks. I wasn't supposed to be there, but I was invited because I'd been involved in one of the key client accounts, or maybe because he wanted me there. I couldn't tell anymore. At dinner, he sat across from me, not beside. He kept it formal, he spoke to others, he laughed, he was charming, but his eyes kept finding mine. After dinner, people drifted to the bar. I stayed at the edge, nursing a drink, watching the partners loosen their ties, watching the directors perform warmth. Ciaran approached me when no one was paying attention. He leaned in and said, "We should talk." My spine stiffened. I said, "Not tonight." He smiled. He said, "You're making this harder than it needs to be." I said, "I'm making it professional." He laughed softly. He said, "You keep saying that word like it's a shield." Then he added, quieter, "If you're planning to make noise, think carefully. It won't go the way you want." That was the first time he was direct enough that my stomach dropped. I looked at him and said, "Are you threatening me?" He lifted his hands slightly, the gesture of innocence again. He said, "I'm advising you, like a mentor." Mentor. He said it like a joke, like he was proud of the irony. I walked away from the bar and went outside into the cold air, my hands shaking. I stood by the hotel's side entrance and tried to breathe. It hit me then that I wasn't just dealing with a man. I was dealing with a system that had chosen him, rewarded him, protected him. Even if I screamed, the system would treat it as inconvenient noise. And I understood something else, something quieter and more brutal. He knew that too. The next day, I requested a meeting with HR anyway. Not because I believed in them, because I needed to stop feeling like I was drowning alone. The HR manager was a woman named Nam, polished and pleasant, with a voice that was always just slightly too calm. She offered me water. She asked how she could help. I told her carefully, not emotionally, not dramatically. I described the mentorship, the boundary blur, the messages, the kiss, the retaliation. As I spoke, I watched her face. She nodded in the right places. She made sympathetic noises. She wrote notes. When I finished, she paused and said, "Thank you for sharing. That must be difficult." Then she asked, "Did you ever explicitly tell him to stop?" I said, "Yes." She asked, "Do you have evidence of retaliation that directly links to this?" I said I had documentation of the changes and messages. She asked, "Were you ever in a consensual relationship with him?" That word, consensual, landed like a trap. I said, "No." She asked, "Did you ever send him messages that could be interpreted as encouraging?" I felt heat rise in my face. I said I replied professionally. She nodded, still calm, still polite. Then she said, "We take these matters seriously. But you understand, these situations can be complex, especially when there are blurred boundaries." Blurred boundaries, as if the blurring had been mutual. I left that meeting feeling hollow, not because she dismissed me outright, but because she'd placed the weight back on me. Complex. Blurred, interpreted, words that let the company avoid naming harm. 2 weeks later, HR told me they'd looked into it and found no breach of policy, but they would encourage professional boundaries moving forward. Encourage, that was it. No consequences for him, no warning I could see, no acknowledgement of retaliation, but something did change, not in my favor. After HR, the air around me shifted. People became careful. Meetings went quiet when I walked in. The friendly chat stopped. It was as if I'd brought a smell into the office that everyone wanted to avoid. Ciaran didn't confront me. He didn't need to. He was suddenly polite, distant, almost respectful. He didn't message me anymore. He didn't touch me. He didn't corner me. Instead, he made me irrelevant. My projects were small. My visibility shrank. My reviews became oddly lukewarm. Not bad enough to sue over. Not good enough to thrive. That's how workplaces punish women who speak without ever admitting they're punishing them. They don't fire you. They starve you. I lasted 3 more months. I tried to push through. I told myself I wouldn't let him win. But every day felt like walking into a room where the rules had changed, and no one would tell me what they were. One Friday, I sat at my desk staring at a blank document and realized I couldn't remember the last time I'd felt proud of my work there. Not because I wasn't capable, because the environment had turned my competence into something heavy. I resigned on a Monday morning. Nayam from HR looked surprised. She asked if I wanted to discuss options. She asked if I'd consider transferring teams. I stared at her and felt something like laughter rise again, bitter and sharp. Transfer teams, as if he wasn't the system, as if moving desks could fix power. I said no. I said I'd made my decision. When I told my manager, he nodded like he'd expected it. He said, "Sorry to lose you. You're talented." Talented, the same word people use like it's consolation instead of protection. On my last day, Sharon stopped by my desk, not to apologize, not to explain. He smiled calm, polished. He said, "I hope you find what you're looking for." I looked up at him and felt a strange stillness. No fear, no longing, just clarity. I said, "I already did. I found the truth." His smile tightened barely. He said, "Take care." And then he walked away, as if I'd been a brief chapter, an experiment, a passing distraction. I left Armitage and Doyle with a box of notebooks and a laptop bag, stepping out into the Dublin air that always smells faintly of rain. I expected to feel relief. I did, in a way. But there was also residue. That's the part people don't talk about. The residue is how you second-guess praise later, how you question mentorship offers, how you feel your body tense when a senior man leans too close, how you learn to read charm as threat. It's also how you mourn the version of yourself who believed she could rise purely on merit. The version of yourself who thought the only obstacles were workload and skill. For a long time afterward, whenever someone complimented me, I'd feel a flicker of suspicion. What do you want? What's the cost? That's what he took from me. More than a job. More than a project. He took ease, and the worst part is that he didn't even have to break me loudly. He just used his charm like a key, unlocked my trust, and then acted surprised when I flinched at the door closing behind me.